Hello and welcome to CJ Evolution, the podcast dedicated to helping criminal justice professionals like you. Now here's your host, fellow CJ Evolutionary, Patrick Fitzgibbons.
Hello everybody, welcome back. Episode 133, Patrick here, CJ Evolution. This is a podcast for the criminal justice professional like you, hosted by me, another criminal justice professional, Patrick here. Whatever you were doing, wherever you were at, thank you for tuning in. Special thanks to all the brave men and women working in the criminal justice field, especially the first responders, doing a very difficult job in a very difficult environment these days. But hopefully it's going to get better. You have millions and millions of people who support you. I know sometimes it doesn't seem that way, but yes, that is true. I am very excited today to have my friend Tracy Kesey on. I asked Tracy to come on several months ago. She graciously agreed, and she graciously agreed this time to come back on. If you don't know who Tracy is, she works for the New York City Police Department in training, and she's just a wonderful person and a great police officer. So without further ado, the one and the only Tracy Kesey. Tracy Kesey, Deputy Commissioner of Training for the NYPD. Welcome back, Tracy.
Thank you, Patrick. I appreciate having me back.
Well, I know you're very, very busy, and I appreciate you taking the time. And for those listeners out there who don't know who Commissioner Tracy is or Kesey is, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and
how you began
your career in law enforcement?
Well, I began my career in law enforcement in Denver, of course, and with Denver PD. So I did 25 years there and retired. I had a wonderful time in Denver. And, of course, you know, you always have a heart for the place that raised you.
Mm-hmm.
And then after retirement, I moved to New York to take on a DOJ initiative called the National Initiative for Building Community Trust and Justice. And then got the call to come to NYPD to see if I could assist in some changes that were already happening in training that help continue move those things forward. And I've been here for the last couple of years, so it's been good.
Nice. And you said something that really, I mean, it was all important, but what's your take on, what do you think the trust is now? I mean, I know you could probably just speak to NYPD, but just kind of the environment now. I think law enforcement's kind of, I think the trust has kind of been eroded to some degree with law enforcement by the public. What's your take, Trace?
I think it depends on how you're defining trust, right? Mm-hmm. I think that for some communities, it's going to mean different things. And if we are, you know, talking about policing in general, it is about that mutual understanding that you will do things in my best interest and you know, vice versa. And to trust that that relationship and bond will always be there, even during tough times.
Mm-hmm.
It also, to me, implies that I also will give, in some sense, a benefit of doubt if something is happening or going wrong, that you will, you know, be open about it, fix it, you know, communicate that with whomever. And I think that what's interesting is we're in this space where, you know, everybody's trying to figure out, you know, what is that? How do you build that? How do you sustain that? And I know, you know, we have a lot of conversations around the fact, you know, there's no magic pill for it. And we think we all, those of us who've been in law enforcement for a long time, you know, certainly know that.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it is built on those relationships, but it's not just relational based. I mean, there's a transaction there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that we call it here, you know, the co-production of public safety is that police have a responsibility and so does community.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's sort of that focus or that premise that we think about, in, especially here, and especially around our neighborhood coordinating officer philosophy sort of embodies a lot of that. So that's the way we're thinking about trust.
But it seems like it's changed. I mean, I've been doing this for 21 years. I know you've been doing it a long time. It seems like we're in a different, you mentioned space. I mean, I know law enforcement, we kind of, you know, we go through peaks and valleys, you know, with, you know, but it just seems different. Am I wrong? Or, I mean, are you getting a sense that maybe it's just me? It just seems like we're in a different place and it seems like it's going to take, I don't know if we could ever get out of it. Maybe, and I'm not trying to sound defeatist or anything because I think we got to have a positive attitude and go out there and work with the community, but it just seems like a different environment we're in. I mean, there's so much anti-police sentiment. I realize that a lot of people, the majority, support law enforcement, but it just seems like a different space we're in.
Well, I think it may be a different space in a sense that it's something that you and I have not necessarily experienced in our time. When I talk to community, you know, especially older community members and my, you know, certainly my mother who was of a different generation, some of this isn't new. I think what is a challenge for us is that we have done a lot of work, you know, in this space of community policing and hopefully building community relationships. And I believe that we thought that we had, you know, a good thing going. And I think that in that case, you know, it also behooves you to sort of take a look at those relationships from time to time to make sure that they are, you know, truly how we're each defining, you know, a relationship. So I think that to me is the new challenge. I think that you're absolutely 100%. So I'm with you on this in regards to it feels different. And it feels different because, you know, we had what we believe to be this toolbox of things that we always sort of relied on. And I don't necessarily think that some of those things are working anymore.
I agree, yeah.
And so it just kind of, it, you know, you kind of are out there like, well, so now what? You know, what are we going to do? And I think, I don't know if it speaks to what you're referring to, but it does for me. It's like, okay, here we have, you know, so many decades in policing. We used to be able to do some of these things, and in some cases, they're not working. And so, you know, how do we begin to identify, you know, what will work or may not work, and then how do we start to step forward on some things?
And I agree
with you. I mean, it does feel big, and it feels different. I just think it's in a different time, and I think for us, it's our time, and we have to figure our way through it.
And we have to evolve, you know that, and we have to change. I mean, we were talking a little bit before we started about, you know, how we need to constantly. I agree with you, Tracy. We can't keep doing things the old way. We have to change. We have to adapt. I think it starts, you know, with getting the right people on board, you know, training, recruitment. And yeah, I mean, that's always a challenge. I don't know if it's a challenge for NYPD, but it certainly is a challenge here in my neck of the woods. It's very hard now to get good recruits. I mean, I don't know if it's the same where you're at, but it's a challenge out there. It seems like, at least in Colorado, you know, everybody's vying for the same people,
right.
You know, and I mean, you know, you're still connected to Colorado, and I mean, it's hard to get good quality applicants, and you want those applicants, you want those good recruits, because they're the ones that are they're obviously the future of the department.
Well, you know, there's two things to that, right? So I'm with you. I mean, I think, you know, recruiting the right people has always been a challenge, even when you and I started. I'm sure that was, you know, a challenge then. But the question I always have to ask is, you know, what is the right person?
True.
You know, what are we talking about and who are we talking about and what kind of skill set, you know, are we asking folks to bring to the table for policing, you know, today? And I know when you and I both came on, you know, you had to have somewhat of a, you know, structure and be more flexible in some spaces, but not all. So we, you know, we certainly see some changes in that. But the other part of this, too, is not just about, you know, who are you recruiting and who you're keeping on. We spend a lot of time and a lot of focus, as we should, on getting recruits ready, you know, to go into the FTO program or the field training officer program. But I also find that sometimes we put a lot more emphasis on recruits than we should be on the rest of the family.
That's a good point.
And I think that's the balance that, you know, we have to begin to do better at. You know, so if we always say from recruitment to retirement, you know, it's one thing to teach recruits, you know, new stuff and have technology, but it's another thing of, you know, leaving everybody else out in those things and having an attitude thinking they might not be able to learn something different or they're incapable. And I think that's where we sort of fall down. And I think here, one of the things that we, you know, are really starting to focus on is the needs of officers. And I think what's interesting, you know, you remember when we came on, there was not much care about what you needed. I mean, you sort of went through and you know, you did what folks told you to do in the academy. And, you know, we're finding that, you know, it's helpful if you kind of understand who and what you're dealing with. And you do have to be supportive around what folks need to sustain themselves through a 30-year career. I think that we have to do much better at that.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And I don't know if this is taught in the academies. I mean, NYPD obviously has their in-house academies, but is that taught? I mean, the emotional wellness, because I think that's what it boils down to. I couldn't agree with you more that so much. We need to take better care of our officers emotionally, physically, because you're right. I mean, this is stuff that we didn't learn, or at least I didn't learn. It was basically right. Suck it up, go out there, do your job. And if you're involved in a critical incident, so what? You're back to work the next day. Nowadays, I'm glad to see that that is changing, at least maybe not in all departments, but, we're focusing more. I wish we would focus on even more, officer well-being,
I think it's very important. We certainly are, absolutely doing, component parts of that in the academy, and there are spaces where we can always do better. I think like a lot of, other police organizations throughout the United States, we have support groups and we certainly have, things that you can reach out to and remain anonymous because, but still the concern is, if somebody finds out that I need some help, this could impact my ability, to be active and to, mm-hmm. To stay on the job. And so we also have to be mindful of that. But I think, too, it's also in the way in which, we generationally look at this, right? Because as you said, when you and I came on, it was critical incident, suck it up, move
yeah.
on.
Yeah.
Right? Not necessarily the most healthiest way to be able to adapt. And we sometimes have a problem when we look at, the next generation coming up, and we have a tendency to, sort of make light of the fact that they may need to have something different than we did. But I also think that that's changing, too. I think as we get older and, we watch suicide issues with us in policing, not necessarily getting better. I mean, they certainly are not where they used to be. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, it's a reality. And I think that we can no longer afford to, sort of make light of folks who are asking and wanting help and being able to give them help. And I think that's a big part of it. I think that, too, it's this wellness piece is interesting. It's something that's always been, with us. And I think that sometimes, you have to live through it to get to it. When you get older, you realize just how precious your health is, mm-hmm. Especially when you're watching, a group of 25-year-old recruits, run a mile and a half and you're just thinking, I remember when I used to do that without my knees hurting and all the extra things. But, this sort of incentivizing ways of keeping folks healthy and thinking about, not just them, but their families, I think is critically important. And we really try to look at things differently.
Yeah.
Some of it's generational. I mean, we have four generations here.
Yeah.
So we try all kinds of things to see what may work.
Now we had a discussion recently, not you and I, but I was having a discussion with some friends recently about the challenge. And I hate to beat up on millennials, but I'm not saying all millennials are a challenge. We had this discussion a few days ago, and I mean, what do you think? Because it does seem like with millennials, that certain generation, they are a little bit harder to manage. I mean, what's your take on that?
They said the same thing about us.
I knew you were going to say that because
this group, they want to carry automatics.
Yeah.
You don't have. I remember a TO telling me that you have to be a poor shot to have 17 and hope you hit one. So we used to have those conversations. I mean, each generation has its challenges, but they also, though, sort of push us to move forward
yeah.
in a lot of different ways that we wouldn't have to. And, one of the examples that I always use, especially with, the new kids coming in, you remember you and I used to do the death by PowerPoint thing, right?
Oh,
and they
God,
would tell
yes.
you to get tired, stand up in the back of the room, hope to God you don't fall asleep and something will happen to you. But I think that one of the things that the new sort of, we call them millennial, new generation or whatever it is, has really forced us to do is to rethink, how we do our training here. And it wasn't just, scenario-based, when needed. It is total engagement as much as possible all the time. They question, they ask questions. You have to encourage them to ask questions. It is not an indictment on the ability to understand rank structure if they ask a question.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a threat to, your authority in the academy. This is just the way that most of them were sort of brought up to learn, to engage in the classroom. And so we've really focused on how we can do that in the short time constraints that we have. But the one thing that they do bring to the table, that everybody will tell you is technology. They're aptitude for technology is quite unbelievable, which is a good thing and a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
So while we find ourselves, maybe in some of our spaces here having to catch other people up to the technology, find myself not just in conversation with folks, but even with conversation of the chief over the academy, Chief Shortell and her team, having to, have folks look up from their cell phones, and you have to reteach them to engage with the human and to be able to balance that, because I believe, and this may change after I retire, you know, for a second time, there will be nothing to replace the human interaction.
No, I agree with that.
That is where you get most of your cues. That's where you can get, you know, most of your understanding about what's going on. And so we found ourselves early on, you know, some chuckle at this, but it was true, having to do sort of this awareness video to pay attention to your surroundings, you know. And there's, you know, some of our, the older folks like myself are shaking our heads going like, really? But for some, you know, it's new. And when you're new into policing, like a lot of these kids are, that is something that really has to be taught again. Communications will never go away for some of us, but for some, it's new. The ability to have a one-on-one conversation without texting it to somebody.
And so much of law enforcement, you know, I mean, is that face-to-face. And I agree with you. I don't think, no matter how much technology we have, nothing is ever going to replace that face-to-face, human-to-human interaction. I mean, I don't care how much technology we get. I mean, and then so much in law enforcement, that's that face-to-face. And But I agree with you.
Absolutely.
I mean, they are definitely more, you know, technologically adept than a lot of people out there. And I know I've, you know, my my son's a millennial, and he helps me with my Snapchat.
Right. Where most people we look at you like, what are you doing with Snapchat? Right. So I mean, but you're right, and I think that this is how we evolve, right?
Yeah.
In policing.
I agree.
You know,
I agree.
As these kids come on in the next 10, 20, 15 years, they're going to be, you know, sergeants and lieutenants and chiefs in some spaces, and that's just the way it's supposed to be.
Well, even like stuff like when you and I started, I mean, it was social media. Now it's every department, well, maybe not every department, but has some sort of social media presence, or they should, I think.
Absolutely. You know, and the idea to be able to get your message out there. I remember, I mean, I was the PIO for Denver for a couple of years, and I remember, you know, you having to be in sync with, you know, media deadlines. When was the news coming on, and hoping people would, you know, get the story right, or hoping people would, you know, report on good news. And you look at it now. I mean, you look at a lot of these Facebook pages, and some of them even have their own web channels. And they're getting their own message out, which is, you know, I always thought was quite impressive.
And a lot of times, before the first responders even get there, the news is out.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Definitely. I mean, you know, video phones, you know, phones, you know, when you and I can think back to, you know, when we watched Rodney King unfold.
Yeah.
And the fact that that person even had a video camera was still, you know, to be talked about then, compared to now, where you have, you know, not just citizens, you know, taking photographs or recording, but now, if you would have never thought it, you know, we're wearing body cameras.
And why do, just, and I'm thinking about it just because you brought it up, and why do, I don't care if somebody is filming me. Why do so many officers get ticked off about this? Maybe not as much as they used to, but they get pissed off when somebody's filming them. So what?
Yeah, well,
who
I
cares?
Mean, we have to do a better job. I know. And we have to do a better job, too, of you know, making sure people understand fully, you know, what everybody's rights are. But, you know, you're absolutely correct. I mean, it's not just, you know, they're going to videotape you. I think you should make sure that you are doing what you need to do the right way.
Of course.
That always comes across, whether it's on body camera or whether it's on somebody's footage. Too many times, you know, we see footage of officers doing it the wrong way, right? And, you know, not necessarily every case. And one of the things, an interesting focus that we have with training around our body worn camera footage is identifying and using those pieces that are sound tactically and in ways that demonstrate that we do understand how the job is done. I mean, there's plenty of folks looking for bad video. Our focus in the training bureau, and we've reviewed, you know, hours of training footage, is to pull out those things that we can use and hold up as examples of, you know, every day. For us anyway, you know, thousands of people that are always doing it right. So I think that's a, you know, for us, that's a good use of the body-worn camera, among other things. But it is, you know, managing all of this technology. I mean, a lot of these kids are coming more wired than we ever were. You know, there's concerns about, you know, safety and all of those things, about making sure they have every little tool possible. But again, you can't get away from, you know, just good common sense and communication.
Now, what do you think some of the other issues or challenges in training are? I mean, just maybe from you know, your perspective with NYPD, but just in general in law enforcement, because I know we talked about this again before. You know, we need to evolve and we need to learn how to do things better, and it's a nonstop process.
Yeah, it's a very much a nonstop process for us. We set up a small group inside of training called the Center for Innovations in Training and Education to try to stay ahead, you know, to think about what are new ways we can do this in a more efficient manner, not just for the sake of change, but a way in which, you know, we can do this and it's something that's sustainable. But probably one of the bigger challenges, you know, other than making sure that officers are staying safe and we keep those soft skills and those hard skills, you know, pretty much up to date. But it's really centering around evidence-based training. And, you know, for decades now, we have done things in the name of training that, you know, we're not necessarily sure if they truly have worked, other than the fact that the officer may make this statement saying, I learned it in the academy. And so, you know, we're high-fiving each other. It's like, oh, that was working. And what I always ask myself is what happens when a mistake is made? No one's high-fiving and owning, right? Everybody's just kind of looking around. So one of the challenges that we have that we've started looking at is, you know, how do we evaluate training long-term? How do we know that when our either recruits or even when they come to in-service, that officers are using it in a way in which they were taught? And then in the reverse, are there things that are being done out there that can inform and make the training better? And that's a process. And that means that we have to feed into a lot of different data sets, whether it's from IA, you know, whether it's from trials, you know, whether it's from spaces from patrol and the command officers who do command level discipline. I mean, it's a constant sort of feeding process, looking for patterns and understanding what's going on and doing this in a timely manner. I mean, so if you can imagine just the size of what we have here, the thing that where technology really does benefit us is, you know, through what we call our NYPD University, is the ability to push things out so folks can see it and hear it and sort of get to it from that space as well. But the challenge, you know, for now is not just keeping things up to date and making sure that people are getting ongoing training. That's the other challenge.
I was going to say, with 40,000, Tracy, is NYPD or just a little less?
around there. But we're, I think we're 53,000 total, and that includes civilians.
So when you train, I mean, not only you push out training, but obviously just the sheer amount of sworn, non-sworn, maybe they don't all get the training, but that has to be spread out over a very, very long time, I imagine.
Well, if you think about it logistically, depending on how many, you know, whether it's a day, whether it's an hour, whether it's an update, I mean, the delivery is done in, you know, through different methods.
Sure,
so, you know,
sure.
If we need
Good
to
point.
Bring someone in for a day training, that depending on the number of instructors we have in that one specific area, can take us up to 2 years, maybe three.
Wow.
You know, depending on, you know, now for us, we go to smaller class sizes for our, you know, our intensive courses. There's no more of this sort of the way we were in college, and you know how we were all in the hall and there's like 1,000 of us in there for the one general ed class. And we were only known by our social security numbers. That's how old I am. You know, they didn't even know your name. But, you know, we know that having a smaller manageable class size of 35 to even sometimes topping out at 40 allows the instructors to be able to evaluate better and to get those learning objectives done in a better way. But that also means that it takes longer to get it done. And so what you have to think about is how do you sort of manage the in-between times, right? So while folks are waiting to get there, we are now, you know, ramping up yet again, you know, more of the video side of the house where we can begin to push sort of intermediate updates, you know, through their phone, desktops, tablets. So we have the whole suite of ways to approach training, not just, you know, being in the classroom, because if we just relied solely on classroom, you know, it does take a while for us to get folks through. And then you have to think about this sort of the distribution, right? So we have training sergeants and out of each of the precincts who help make up sort of the cadre of, you know, adjunct, think of them as adjunct professors to get those things done out there, as well as look at their own training needs specific to their precincts, neighborhoods, and communities. So, I mean, you think of it from a systems perspective, it's always going, it's always moving. And you just sort of have to think about it in different ways. And we do, we're lucky in training, we have a lot of, you know, expertise in-house, but we also have a lot of folks who go out and interact with, you know, just about anybody and everybody, because mm-hmm. it is, you know, how you share that knowledge is, you know, how we sort of stay ahead of the game and try to figure out what's going on. So we keep the academy and the training bureau pretty open to folks, you know, who want to come visit and walk through. Regionally, you know, we certainly try to be good training partners, and so we'll put extra, you know, chairs in the classroom for some of our local police departments and sort of put them in there that way. But we have a responsibility, so it's not just, you know, to training our recruits and our senior members, training the academy and training community. I mean, we have community involved in helping us develop curriculum. Mm-hmm. So it is, it's this ongoing, you know, process, but it's one that has to have a lot of, you know, involvement, engagement. You know, we've engaged with the unions on topics that are, you know, critical to their, you know, groups that they represent. So, I mean, it's always moving. It's something that you have to really think about and be on top of.
Yeah, I was going to say you have to be on top of it. I mean, I do some of the training in my department, of course, you know, a smaller department. I can't imagine, you know, it's a nonstop challenge probably with an organization such as NYPD. I mean, it's just the sheer size. What is the typical academy class? How many cadets are in a typical
class?
Well,
we hire quarterly.
Quarterly.
And so we do an average of, about 500 a quarter.
Wow.
And then we always have two classes in. So we graduate probably about 2,000 a year.
Wow. That's amazing.
Around there. And I mean, although we might be, you know, difference in size, we still go through the same process.
Oh, sure.
When it comes to training. You know, we do more of it, but, you know, it is the same thing. You know, good curriculum, good instructors, good recruits. I mean, a lot of folks, the things that you experience with your recruits, we do as well, just on a larger scale.
I was going to say on a larger scale. You know?
Yeah, so absolutely. And we're lucky, too. We're very lucky because we have this, you know, brand-new billion-dollar facility.
Wow.
It's absolutely stunning. And the facility, training facility matters. I'm an advocate of, you know, unfortunately, probably making a lot of chiefs and PCs around the United States cringe, but training facilities matter, and they have to matter.
Now, what do you mean by training facilities matter? I mean, obviously, training's important in the environment. Okay.
The environment in which you train people is critically important. You know, so it's not just, you know, can you convert these two chairs and let's pretend like it's a car? You know, let's use your imagination. It is, you know, you have to be able to replicate as much as possible internally. So you can begin to sort of gauge their development, with, you know, much of which they're going to experience when they're on the street. So I, you know, I'm all for, you know, I have folks walking through who are thinking about building, you know, new academies, and people who just want to see what it looks like. And I think it's critically important.
And you get probably departments surrounding that want to use your facilities, I imagine.
And we do that. We open that up. We have scenario floors here that have, you know, they have apartments. They have a streetscape with banks and grocery stores and things like that. We have a subway car. We have, you know, courtrooms, and it's important. It's important to get these kids in and sort of get the anxiety down as much as you can before you put them on the street.
Now, what about challenges, Tracy? We talked a little bit about some challenges law enforcement faces. Is there any other thing or any other specifics that you think are challenges for law enforcement? I know one that I think of right now is just a leadership challenge, I think.
Yeah.
And that's probably common among all departments. I mean, I think making sure that we have the leadership in place, the correct, now we can, what does that mean? The correct leadership, but people who are out there leading, making good, sound decisions, being well-rounded. I think that's a challenge with law enforcement today.
You know, it's a challenge, but you have to also think about it now, you know, who are the chiefs of today, right? Mm-hmm. There are a lot of the folks that, you know, we grew up with and, you know, maybe a little bit older, but not much. And, you know, I like to think that, you know, the next generation of chiefs, deputy chiefs or whomever, were exposed to a lot more. Mm-hmm. They definitely, I think, are challenged in a way in that they are facing, you know, issues of trust in communities and sometimes trust within their own organizations that, you know, prove to be problematic for some folks. And I think a bigger question is, where do you go to get that type of support and help that you need to focus? The leadership's a little different. I mean, I think that, you know, you can remember times where you and I would probably never see the chief. The only person you really got to know was your sergeant. Mm-hmm. That was about it. And I think that the current leadership now that I see throughout, lots of new chiefs being appointed here over the last 6 or 7 months or so, they're known for their engagement with their law enforcement officers.
I was going to say, leading by walking around.
Some of that, yeah, but, you know, it's not just this, you know you're going to, you know, certainly have to have that relationship with the community and then your boss politically, mm-hmm. but they're also a voice inside their own organization. That a lot of times the officers, if you, you know, ask what does your PC think about this, they should be able to have some idea, you know, of what that is, whether you agree or disagree. And I think that you see that a lot more are beginning to turn inside as well. So primarily, I know when I was coming up, primarily there was a, you know, although it's still there, there was a larger focus on, you know, community, you know, needs first. And now there is this need to balance that. Right? Because I think the reality is that if the officers, you know, are not understanding what they need to get done, it's not going to get done. And I think that one of the things that we do here, you know, well, and I think that especially among this leadership team is, you know, you have to communicate. You got to understand, mm-hmm. you know, what the priorities of the PC are, and then you have to figure out how do you push that down and get feedback from it. Because the other thing that's new, which it just kind of tickles me, is that, you know, we have for so long sort of dismissed police officers as they are, you know, they're going to do whatever you want them to do. Just tell them to do it, mm-hmm. right? And to some extent, that's true when it's a crisis. You know, they certainly will react. But there's now this acknowledgement that, you know, cops have an opinion.
Oh, yeah.
And it's
very strong opinion.
You know, you know, we always had a strong, we continue to have yeah. strong opinions, right? And, you know, how they're informed sometimes, they're a little different, but, you know, and you have to be able to understand that and work with that. And I think that is proven to be very interesting to the leadership. I think a lot of folks that are, you know, sort of on their game get that and figure out ways to try to get to it. But, you know, I think that's probably one of the bigger, you know, challenges. So I agree with you. So leadership is an interesting.
So what do you do
right
as a senior member of a department? I'm not to talk about you, but I mean anybody like in a senior leadership role. And obviously you want to connect with your subordinates. You want to be, you know, you want to be talking to them. But you know as well as I do, there's always going to be the naysayers. There's always going to be people in organizations that don't agree with it. The very negative people, negative officers. You know it. You have them. I have them. How do you try to get through to those officers? Because there's always going to be the people that say, "Eh, Commissioner Kesey, I don't agree with her, and I'm not going to do what she's telling me to do." And, I mean, how
well,
do you?
The reality is that there are some of those people, mm-hmm. right? And I think we have to stop pretending like there isn't.
Of course, yeah, I agree.
The question is, who are you managing and how are you managing? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's always folks that will, you know, no matter who says it, will go ahead and do, you know, what you ask them to do. There are others who will ask questions and you know, either will go along with it. And then, you know, the ones that just absolutely don't want to do anything, I think it's probably something that happened way before, you know, my arrival or somebody else's arrival. Mm-hmm. Usually your aversion to not just change, but aversion to an individual or individual group of people was not just born overnight. And so you have to be able, I think, to understand where, you know, the perspectives that are coming at you as far as those are absolute complete naysayers. But there's a process for that, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you do give folks the opportunity to say what they need to say and to be heard and to honestly, legitimately take those things into consideration, not just, you know, already made the decision and then we're just going to roll with it no matter what, you know, people say. But then, you know, there's a time when you move on. Mm-hmm. You can't wait for everybody.
True.
Right? And so those things have a tendency to take care of themselves in some cases. And so I always ask the question, you know, well, who are you managing? I mean, there's, and we know this in policing, there's always going to be people.
Exactly.
Who are critics. We're our own worst critics.
Yeah.
Right? So, I mean, there are always going to be people who are not going to be happy about something. The question is, who are you managing for and who are you leading for? The people who are not happy?
Yeah.
That's not That's not how that works. So we do a lot of, you know, we try to do a lot of that conversation. And, you know, internally, when you talk about looking at, you know, you've heard a lot of folks talk about, you know, procedural justice and all those things. There's, you know, this internal procedural justice piece that's equally as critical. I mean, how people are treated, you know, inside their organization, how they are heard, whether or not they are legitimately taken seriously. All of those things matter when you're mm-hmm. asking people to go out and engage with community in an honest effort. I think that's you know, part of that leadership challenge right mm-hmm. now. How do you do that?
And I really do believe that some of the most powerful people in a police organization, I don't care how big it is, are your mid-level, like sergeants, you know, lieutenants, mm-hmm. captains. They are really the ones. They are the ones, really, I think, that have the majority of power. It's not the chief, or the, you know, I mean, the chief, you know, has the you know, mission, values, tone, but it's really those mid-level managers that are really going to have the most positive or negative or positive impact on the troops.
Well, sure. I mean, anybody who's been raised in an organization, you mm-hmm. know, knows how that goes, right? It is one in which it's not just, you know, senior leadership. It truly is about how do you engage everybody and, you know, and hopefully help them understand where you're going, what you're trying to do. But again, you know, as we were talking about, there's a recognition where you're going to have some folks who just stuck and don't want to move. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's processes for that as well. But I think that, you know, as we look at that and we say, you know, where does, you know, the power, you know, exist? I think the power looks different on each level. But you also look about how culture is sustained and held, right? Mm-hmm. And you'll get a lot of discussion around, you know, how do you help folks move forward? Because that's what we're talking about, right? We're talking about evolution. You and I may have been promoted or rewarded for things that have changed now that you probably wouldn't get rewarded for today.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
You know, that's the way things, you know, happen to move on. And how you help folks understand that and manage through that is equally as important.
That's excellent. Well, Commissioner Tracy Kesey, I sure do appreciate you coming on once again to the show. If people want to reach out to you, how can they find you?
Oh, easy. You can definitely go. It's always easy. You know, that's what they say, right, for sales. It's always so easy to get a hold of me. You certainly can get a hold of me. My email address is tracy.kazee@nypd.org. That's probably the easiest way to get a hold of me.
And what about Twitter? What about Twitter, Tracy?
NYPD training. Yes, I'm admitting there's the social media portion to me. So we definitely are on Twitter. But, you know, I always enjoy having conversations. I had one prior to talking to you with some folks, you know, out of Florida in law enforcement. And we're all in the same space.
Yep.
We're all just trying to figure out how do we move forward and what does that look like? And, you know, what kind of language do we use going forward? So I always appreciate talking to you. You know,
I mean, we love you on here and you're always welcome on. And thank you so much for taking time today, Tracy. And
I want you to pleasure. Have a... Thanks for my connection home.
Alrighty. All right. Take care. Right. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to CJ Evolution. Be sure to head over to iTunes and rate and review the podcast and reach out to Patrick on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, Anchor, or Snapchat. We'll see you next time on CJ Evolution.